Hello and welcome to the Interfish Podcast, where we bring you the week's most interesting and compelling seafood news. I am editor Drew Cherry, joined today by executive editor John Fiorillo, as well as correspondent John Evans, who you'll hear from in just a moment. Okay, a very, very busy week in seafood. Just a couple of the headlines. Clothing giant Patagonia launched another broadside against the salmon farming industry, this time in Iceland with a new film and a new campaign. The M&A advisors handling the American seafood sale may be closer to finding a buyer for the pollock giant, but a lot of questions remain about whether or not and how that deal might go through. And then another big M&A, MSD, a division of pharmaceutical giant Merck, acquired aquaculture health giant Elanco in a $1.3 billion deal, just the latest in the consolidation of the supply sector to the aquaculture industry. Later on in the show, we're going to speak with Brian Vinci. He's with the Freshwater Institute and an expert in land-based aquaculture. And we're going to get a view of just what the future looks like for land-based salmon farming. But first, we're going to take you to a stretch of Chile's Ruta 5, this 150-kilometer stretch between the towns of Cabrero and Victoria in Chile, is one of the most violent for truckers moving salmon. Now, John Evans, who's joining us, did a fantastic look into the violence in Chile and these robberies, what they mean in terms of financial losses, and what the industry is doing to combat it. John, tell us about salmon truck robberies.
Yeah, well, it's kind of come to light with the trade body Salmon Chile having released figures before Christmas, which was published in the Chilean press, I should say, showing that nearly 139 armed robberies took place between 2019 and November 2023, the start of 2019, that is. And it's difficult to say. I mean, is this the thin end of the wedge, so to speak? Because it's not clear whether these 139 robberies are the ones that have just been reported. It's believed that many more actually have gone unreported. And while, you know, the sort of losses from these robberies are around 22 million. You know, they said not only this time, but in the past, that they could be losing as much as $80 million a year from these kind of incidents.
Now, what do we know about the robbers and how they move this salmon and where it ends up going after they steal it?
Well, it has been said that a lot, if not all, of the salmon sold in the south of Chile, or large quantities, shall we say, have been stolen. It's difficult to know what is legal and what isn't in some cases. The police have had some successes tracking it down, but they seem to be the exception rather than the rule.
So it might be sold roadside markets, or as you said, making its way even into possibly legitimate grocery stores, but mixed in with product that's been legally obtained.
Yeah, and even illegally processed. Believe it or not, the police have uncovered quantities of salmon which have been illegally processed, not by the mainstream companies that we report about every day.
So, all right, tell us a little bit about how the industry is reacting, because, you know, I was looking in our archive and these robberies have stretched a long way back. I mean, this has been an epidemic, you might say, for the industry. And so there has to be some efforts here to combat it. Tell us what those are.
Yeah, well, one of the main things, particularly Kamanchaka, Salmonus Kamanchaka reports, is investing in anti-jammer systems. That's because the criminals are using jamming systems, believe it or not, to block GPS systems. There's all kinds of other things that they're introducing: geo-reference systems, bulletproof vests, all kinds, all manner of things, really. Let's not forget they're investing in, as not just in Chile and other countries in South America, in private security firms to help escort their produce as it leaves processing plants.
Right, and that obviously is going to come with significant amount of cost. So what are the executives in Chile telling you about what this is adding to, or taking away rather, from their bottom line?
Yeah, they're not really saying, they're being a bit coy about what's happening to profitability, but they are saying that it is increasing costs, and particularly insurance costs. It's difficult to know. I'm not sure they publish every quarter or every year items like that in their balance sheet. Maybe they put it down to other things because they don't want it to be made public.
Now, some of it, you know, even once it's stolen, some of it's making its way, you know, onto the water. Actually, the Chilean Navy made a bust on a vessel that had more than 7.5 metric tons of salmon. So, I mean, this is a pretty sophisticated operation, finding a lot of different markets for their stolen fish.
Yeah, I mean, it's unclear from the Navy report, but it was the gang was disrupted off the island of Chiloé, off Chile's western coast, which is accessible by ferry or boat. In this case, they were carrying it on a small boat. Whether it was processed, because there are processing facilities in Keong itself. As you remember, a few years ago, there was other actions taken. I think it may have been, if I remember rightly, linked to the bus fare process, which started in Santiago and spread throughout the rest of the country. And Chiloé itself became cut off. But so, yes.
So how is the government of Chile? Obviously, you know, you mentioned in the story that truckers' unions are paying a lot more attention to it as well, because, you know, at the end of the day, the most important thing, right, is there's human beings driving these trucks, and that kind of violence is terrible for them and their families, and they're just trying to make a livelihood. What has the government said that it will do to step in and do anything? Are they feeling any pressure to act on this?
It's, well, a commission of congressional lawmakers was set up before Christmas to look into the effects and what is actually happening with illegal salmon. So we'll kind of have to wait to see what they, you know, evidence they garner and what conclusions they reach on that. But at least it shows that they're taking it seriously. And the industry, of course, is putting a lot of pressure on them to do so.
Well, thank you, John. We'll keep up on the story and report it to our readers as we learn more. Land-based salmon farming, once a darling of investors in the stock market, has taken a hit over the past 18 months with fish losses at some of the market leaders, rising interest rates, and a general skepticism among backers, resulting in many, many suspended projects. The market leader, Miami-based Atlantic Sapphire, was at one point valued at around $1 billion on the stock market. Gives you a sense of just how much enthusiasm there was around this industry. But that's changed a bit. Joining us, we have the Freshwater Institute Director, Brian Vinci. And Brian, I guess in short, is the boom over in land-based?
Well, first, thanks for having me, Drew and John, on the podcast. I really enjoy listening to it. It's got a great information packed content almost every episode. So, well, is the boom over? Based on what we see that you guys report and other reports, and then also the inquiries that we get through, you know, advice for technology or questions about technology providers and those kinds of inquiries, I'd say we are definitely down from where we were 5 years ago. If you want to think about when Atlantic Sapphire was building, I guess that was 2017-ish, 2018, the Florida facility, there definitely was a lot of excitement, a lot of interest from investors, you know, ringing us up, sending us emails, and then, of course, the reporting that you guys did and all the projects that were being planned that honestly really never happened. So we're probably down to a more realistic set of projects that are slowly developing. I would say if you're measuring the boom in terms of excitement and news stories and inquiries, yeah, it's over.
So what do you think had investors or projects themselves kind of turning away? Was just the overall economy and how that tracked and interest rates and the high capex costs, or were there other things? Was it just sort of a dose of reality?
Honestly, Drew, I think the latter, what you just said, that's a great way to put it. It's a, dose of reality, and you guys know from my letters back to you to Interfish that I'm very much a realist. And I think it's less about interest rates and more about understanding that there are significant risks in the land-based sector, and you have to address all of those risks, you know, including things like the ability to raise capital, construction delays and construction cost overruns, and then once you're operating, you know, the ability for the systems to perform and the fish to perform and actually, you know, turn a profit on the sales. It's, there's a lot of risks in the sector to have a successful business. And I think early on, it was just like any new thing, there's a lot of excitement about it. And you know, this is a great way to address some of the sustainability issues for wild fisheries, you know, bringing the food production on land and containing waste and maybe lower carbon footprint and all that stuff. And I just think it was after 5 years, just the reality set in and seeing how hard these projects are to actually get up and running successfully. I mean, I can't think of anybody who's had a really easy go of it. Can you?
Yeah. Well, no. I mean, it's, I think that's the challenge, is that I think a lot of, as you said, a lot of excitement. It ticks a lot of the sustainability boxes as part of the circular economy and the interest in that. But I'm curious, Brian, when you, say that, you know, along with this dose of reality, and I think people often forget sort of the big picture looks great, but then ultimately you have to grow fish, and that is not easy, and it's certainly not easy in RAS. But I'm curious, just from this kind of rise and maybe plateau of interest, what problems have been solved? I mean, what can we say has gotten better over the course of, let's say, the last 5 to 10 years, just with the technology?
Yeah. Let me take just a little bit wider view of the question and say, just identifying some of these risks by seeing where other companies have failed is actually advancing for newer projects, right? So they can learn from where other projects had issues. For example, we'll just take a couple of projects in Maine that or that had issues with local opposition, right? And if you're someone sitting on the sidelines thinking about maybe investing or getting into a project, and you see a project have tremendous local opposition and have to go through the courts and have to go through state permitting and really see how that, that's a risk to any project, you know, fish farming or, you know, making sneakers. So they would, you see that and say, oh, well, I need to address that upfront, and I need to do a better job of that. And I actually think the Kingfish Company saw some of that happening in Maine. And even though they had selected a site in Maine, they did a lot of homework upfront to address that risk. Now, on the technology side, so you're talking to somebody who's, you know, engineer and, worked on the technology or working on the technology for my entire career. We have definitely been progressing the technology as we go along. How technology is implemented is really, I think, what you're getting at, which is, are people doing a better job implementing technology that will keep fish alive, have good fish health and welfare, growth, and ultimately sales? And I would like to think that the farmers out there are learning, not cutting corners where maybe they would have in, the beginning. Because, you know, everyone's pressed for capital expenses, you know, they have to raise money to pay for everything. And, well, maybe you can leave this out of a project, or maybe you won't have to chill water, or you won't have to treat your effluent, or, you know, you're trying to thread that needle and do just what you need to do to get something up and running, because, you know, it's a long time to cash flow in the salmon world, right? 2 years at minimum. And I think what people are learning is that cutting those corners is not going to make it. It's not going to get you there, because the negative consequences of maybe leaving something out will have a tremendous detrimental effect on the entire enterprise. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And it brings me to the next question, Brian. You know, when we talk land base, it's predominantly salmon, and we understand all the issues with the salmon guys. But there are other species being raised using RAS technology in land base facilities. Shrimp, for example, yellowtail, some sea bass, some striped bass, turbot as well. And can you tell us a little bit? Can you kind of compare the prospects for those species versus what we've seen as largely a failure, at least, you know, to a large degree for salmon?
Sure, John. But let's not call it a failure just yet.
Okay. I got ahead of myself. Sorry.
That's a great question. And of course, you mentioned a bunch of the species that are being grown in RAS, even in the U.S. Companies like Ideal Fish in Connecticut have been growing sea bass now, and have actually had to make changes to their setup to, you know, to meet their production. And, you know, they're doing well now, or they appear to be doing well now. And you didn't mention tilapia, but of course, the largest land-based fish farm in the U.S. is Blue Ridge Fisheries in Virginia, and they've been around for a long time, growing whole live tilapia for sale to markets in New York City and Toronto and Washington. I also just want to mention that eel, and that's a really interesting one, is Sarah Rademacher up in Maine growing eel, seems to be doing well. You know, that was a project born out of a lot of, I think, sweat equity, and now raising money, and that's a great thing. So I look at all the various species that could be grown, and I always think, okay, what's the seed stock supply? Like, it's one of these most fundamental questions. And that's one of the reasons why I think salmon, you know, dominated early on. And there is a great domesticated seed stock supply for Atlantic salmon, whether it's, you know, internal to some of these companies like Movi, or, you know, Stofisk or Benchmark Genetics, has been running breeding programs for Atlantic salmon for many years. They're, you know, have good genetic selection techniques, and they're providing, you know, eggs that maybe even address very specific things that could be beneficial, whether it's in land-based or in the net pen. So, you know, that's why I think that a lot of that excitement and startup went to the salmon, because, you know, there's great seed stock supply. Now, there's good seed stock supply in trout and Hema seafood, and Norway is taking advantage of that. There's good seed stock supply in European sea bass. There are hatcheries in Europe that provide very small fry for shipping around the world, and that's successful. But when I look at the industry in general, where I'm trying to get to is what I think is actually going to be has a real great potential, and likely to be where we see more interest, investment, and startups is in shrimp, growing shrimp and RAS, like Homegrown is doing down in Florida. I recently visited, I guess, just a couple weeks ago. And, you know, I can clearly see the benefits both on, you know, the ability to keep CapEx down, keep OpEx down, and grow something that has a really quick turnover, 90-day cropping, really gets you to cash flow a lot faster than 24 months. So I do think that, you know, it's nice to have the variety of species, and that's great. We see some of that. But in the U.S. especially, you know, you have to do a lot of consumer education if you want to start selling a fish they're not familiar with. And tilapia folks know that really well. I think shrimp is kind of almost a no-brainer. The U.S. market accepts it. They understand it. They eat it. I think it's, if I'm not mistaken, John, it's the number one seafood consumed in the U.S. So I actually, as I see that some of the large shrimp companies like CP Foods get into this area with homegrown, I see that area maturing actually a little bit faster. And companies like Homegrown Shrimp of Florida, you know, may be providing the seed stock supply for additional farms. And that's kind of an exciting model.
Yeah, because that ability to flip your inventory, so to speak, or your production every 90 days versus salmon, trout, roughly, you know, 18 months to 2 years. I mean, the longer that time period, the more chance for something to go wrong, right? But so that brings me to another question. You know, when salmon exploded, Atlantic Sapphire talked about, you know, obviously this massive scale operation, but the ones we're watching that are doing well are still small, 1,000 metric tons to the. My question is, should salmon stay small in terms of production, 5,000 metric tons or less, and abandon the idea of, you know, 30,000 metric tons or whatever number you want to throw out there?
Yeah, great question. I'm, you know, really just on the side. I'm not someone out there actually growing massive amounts of salmon every day, although we do run a small operation here, very small. I think the answer to that is no, you don't have to not scale it up. I mean, I think scaling up will still have benefits, but jumping to a huge scale right off the bat has tremendous risk. And, you know, you have to have something, a model that's working well that you feel is replicable and scalable before you start making the leap. So I look favorably upon these companies that are doing, you know, smaller system setups that can be replicated. And that replication would then take advantage of the economies of scale that would allow them to build out to 30,000 or 60,000 tons. So, and I do think most of the technology providers understand that. I don't think this is secret sauce or, you know, or magic. You have to have something that you can prove out that will work, and it's at a scale that makes sense to replicate. When I say replicate, I don't mean like have six tanks in a system and just make them bigger. I mean, have a system that is large enough so that it is scalable, that just having replicates of that system make sense, and that you could actually get to scale. And that's where you will see unit price economies of scale.
So, you know, the challenge with having this large scale is that when there are problems, the losses can be massive. They can be significant. And just going back to the tech and going back to some of the issues that have sort of bedeviled land-based salmon, at least, how are we on issues like oxygen? How advanced have you come on that? I'm also going to ask, of course, about off flavors and geosmin. Maybe you can explain that because it gets a little bit technical, but those two issues seem quite big, or have been quite big. Are we closer to solving those?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, some of the research that we do at the Freshwater Institute, some of our scientists, John Davidson on the off-flavor issue, and some of our work on the engineering technology side, you know, definitely are advancing those and improving efficiencies. But I want to come back to something you started out with, Drew, which is you said, okay, you're running, the scale presents a risk because, you know, before you get to harvest, if you have an upset or an inability to control water quality, you know, you can have catastrophic losses. And absolutely, that is something that everybody who's going to be jumping in, investment, operator, owner, should go in with open eyes on that. And that's why I think this move to build essentially something that's replicable and scalable, a module of sorts that's large enough so that it makes sense to scale up without having to go to some massive infrastructures. It just... a scale such that even if you were to lose or have an upset in system like that, it wouldn't be catastrophic to the business. So this is actually just a straight out risk analysis, you know, widgets analysis, like how many things do you break your entire harvest up into, and how is that staggered so that if you did lose the system or you had an upset, that it's not catastrophic to the entire operation. So I think even though that's not necessarily, I mean, it's based on technology for RAS, it's just simple, you know, risk assessment and risk mitigation. And that also goes through things like, you know, backup generators and things like oxygen. So you mentioned oxygen. You know, are we getting better in efficiency in the use of oxygen? I would say that a lot of the work in oxygenation was done in the 1980s, both in Europe and the U.S., the part that I'm aware of anyways. And you know, you can achieve relatively good oxygen efficiencies. You know, how much of the oxygen that you actually add gets into the water typically is in this 70% to 90% range, just with, you know, basic technologies. We're still seeing those technologies in use in technology setups and RAS designs now, but there are advancements being made and improvements in some of that. Things like I don't want to say that I understand what's going on with the nanobubble technology, but apparently, you know, they also have very good oxygen transfer efficiencies, you know, 80% and 90%, and there are ways to improve your oxygen use even greater. So you know, that technology was developed quite a while ago, and I think, you know, there's still a little bit of work to be done there. And then you mentioned on off flavors. Off flavor is super important because, you know, you go through 24 months with salmon or 18 months with trout, and both of those fish tend to have a little bit more fat in them, and fat will tend to accumulate these compounds in the water that bacteria produce that have a musty or off flavor to musty flavor to them. So it's particularly important in fish that have some fat in their flesh, like salmon and trout, that you make sure that you do a good job monitoring for off flavor in the product before it goes out to the wholesale or out to the restaurant. So that's super important. And we actually have been, I think, out front on this really well, coming up with standard operating practices that can be used to make sure that fish that are going out the door don't have off flavor, just through some simple processes like deporation, which is really taking the fish out of the RAS and then holding them for a bit in a clean water system and optimizing that so that, you know, it's minimal days. In our case, we have an SOP that takes us about 6 days to just ensure we have very low off flavor, that there's no musty taste to the fillet when it's processed. And we continue to work on that. In fact, John Davidson, one of our research scientists, has been working with both USDA through the Sustainable Aquaculture Systems for Salmon project, and with the Binational Israeli Agricultural Research funding agency with Yap Van Rijn in university over there. And we're all trying different things. And what we're finding is, well, we always thought that you didn't have to feed fish during the purging process, that adding the feed to the systems where the fish were being held would have a negative effect on that. And John recently was looking at some really interesting data that shows us, well, that may not be the case. And you don't necessarily have to lose a couple percent of body weight while the fish are being deprated. And there are also some new technologies that have been advanced, things like advanced oxidation to try and remove off flavor from a normal operating RAS, where the fish would actually be grown for during their lifetime, and ways to keep the off flavor down. What I'll tell you is that here at our place, we are unique in that our water coming in doesn't have any off flavor. And then for whatever reason, our system design does not seem to generate those off flavor compounds. And I think that's partly effect of the water and partly effect of the type of recirculating technology that we use. And so for us to do this experiment on off flavor is actually really difficult for John. And so he has to come up with ways to create off flavor. But what that tells us, though, is that there are practices that we still need to identify within RAS technology that will keep the off-flavor compounds that the bacteria generate, keep them low, because our systems already do that. So either if you have an identical system, of course, that would work, I suppose. But we're still looking at things like the microbiome and how mature the microbiome is, and how that affects the compounds that you mentioned, geosmin and methyl isoborneol.
Brian, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the state of Maine. You referenced community pushback in many places, and probably no more so than in Maine. Tough permitting processes, again, no more so in Maine. But Maine started out, it was such a wonderful story about several companies planning to build these land-based salmon operations in Maine, and one by one they've either receded or given up in some form or fashion. What's your prognosis for Maine? Will we see a recovery, a resurgence there, or is that over, do you think?
John, I knew you'd bring me into this one.
Sorry.
It's okay. Only because we've gone back and forth on this. I don't think it's over for Maine. And I think that they had really one big upset there. And I can say that because if you look at American Unagi, which is Sarah Rademacher's eel RAS, and you look at the Kingfish Company, they're still progressing in Maine. Of course, the American Unagi is already there and producing, and Kingfish is there. And yes, they're producing, but it's at the university's Center for Cooperative Aquaculture Research. But I think they did a lot of homework. Let me just say, I know they did a lot of homework at the Kingfish Company, working with the community. I think it was Jonesport, if I'm not mistaken. And, they seem to have overcome where other people may have fallen down there. So, and Eric Heim, of course, who was originally affiliated with Nordic Aqua Farm, is now doing a project called Katahdin Salmon, and he also seems to have wonderful community buy-in there. We'll see how that project progresses, but I'm encouraged by the American Unagi project on the RAS for eel, and the continued slow but steady progress by the Kingfish Company, and then Eric's willingness to start another venture there in Maine with Katahdin Salmon. So I don't think it's over. I think in many ways it's like the industry. There was a big bit of excitement and activity and announcements, and then the reality is set in, and now we're back to what I would say a more sustainable approach to project development in land-based RAS.
So Atlantic Sapphire at one point was worth $1 billion on the stock market, which is just absolutely stunning. And it's fallen far, 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 far down below that now at this stage. Some companies have raised money on GoFundMe pages. What's the right investor for land-based salmon then? I mean, it seemed like there was all manner of people that were looking to finance these projects. I mean, where do you think it's going to go? Is it going to be more public listing? Is it going to be maybe a little more scaled back, a little more realistic with smaller funders?
Yeah. So, do you ever feel like there's something you really shouldn't talk about because you know nothing about? So investment and public investment and shareholder interest in land-based salmon companies. Now, I actually look at the large variety of the way projects have been capitalized. And you mentioned Atlantic Sapphire going on, I think, the Oslo stock market. And then, there's these other ones I can think of, like Matorka in Iceland, which is partly funded by local private investment in Iceland paired with AquaSpark investment. And then, of course, smaller projects that have been got off the ground through state and federal grants and then haven't been able to attract local investment. I think that's the American Unagi story. And then just, like Ideal Fish, smaller private investors there. Looking at it in whole, I actually think that some of the commercial salmon farmers are in the best position to stand these projects up. And I think specifically about the Grieg project. I think Grieg, if I'm not mistaken, you guys can tell me, having reported on it, but I think Grieg is involved in the Proxmart project. Is that correct?
Correct. Well, the Grieg family is, yep.
Yeah. And I know, of course, they had, the Grieg family was similarly, I think, involved in the project that was going to be on the East Coast of Canada. And now I saw an article that maybe, you know, the company itself was going to be getting involved in one of those projects, either the one in Japan, Proxima, or the one on the East Coast. So I think those family owned or family primarily owned companies that are also publicly traded, of course, and are in a great position to lend the credibility to get a project funded. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a really small project. You know, I don't think it has to be a 500 ton project. You know, they could put their heft and their credibility behind it to really stand it up at a larger scale. That said, I don't think we're quite there. We're Moe and Cermaq and Grieg, although Cermaq, again, I think they're somewhat involved in the Proxmart project through Mitsubishi. But putting that aside, I think these projects, you know, even in the 50 to 100 million range, that's a lot of capital to raise. And I was talking with an investor recently. He organizes workshops for folks in agriculture and agriculture startups. And he was considering having aquaculture, land-based aquaculture on the agenda. And we were talking about, you know, what are the challenges? And, you know, really, it's a lot of money. And when you compare how much it takes to start up even a small project in land-based aquaculture and compare it to other startups, right? It's a lot, you know, it's a considerable amount of money. So how people raise that, that's just the part where it's like, I'm not qualified to talk about this, right? How people raise that, I'm not an investment type, is a little bit beyond me. But, you know, there are interesting flavors of that, the different layer cakes using bonding or investment, or I'm not sure the public stock market makes a whole lot of sense, but that's just me.
So, Brian, take us forward then a little bit. Maybe the boom is over in the sense of the kind of excitement, the external excitement, and maybe now we're back to a bit more of a practical view of what it's going to take to grow the sector. Take us 5-10 years out. Where are we with land-based aquaculture in terms of the size, in terms of just what the landscape might look like in the United States and globally? Just give us your view.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually think the 5-10 year time frame is really hard to predict. It's the 25-30 year time frame that might be a little bit easier, because I do expect that as more projects become successful and some of the risks are more clearly identified, that strategies to address them and also piggybacking on the success of those that are successful will actually grow the sector considerably over time. And in the U.S., for example, I'm comfortable saying that, you know, half of the salmon produced or consumed in the U.S. Would be from land-based, in that 30-year time frame. You know, I know it's a bit out there, right? You want to know 5-10. But I think, you know, as we go through this time from 5-10 all the way out there, I do think we're going to see a considerable portion of the U.S. market for salmon come from land-based. Now, in the 5-10 year range, I'm not so optimistic because it takes a while for these projects to develop. I mean, I could say, well, I expect, 100,000 tons of salmon in 5 years. I'm not sure would come from land-based. I'm not sure we would get there. I mean, there 5 years, you know, that's barely enough time to get the project designed, permitted, built, and started, right? So that five-year window, I'm not sure how much is actually going to change in the next 5 years. We may see some new projects, and we see other projects maybe like Skagen in Skagen salmon in Europe, coming up and, starting to hit maybe their metrics. I know Danish salmon is starting to hit their metrics. So I think, you know, we'll see some of these 1,000, 5,000-ton projects on the salmon side start to check boxes, but that's not going to be, you know, 100,000 tons in 5 years. I'm not even sure it's going to be 50,000 tons in 5 years, but 10 years, I'm a little bit more optimistic because I do think we'll be going through that development curve and we will start to have some taking a portion of the market globally and producing it on land, especially on the salmon side. And then, you know, some of these new projects like the HEMA project in Norway on trout and I know we haven't really talked about non-RAS projects, but, you know, is I want to say pure salmon. Is that the right? They're like a hybrid in Norway.
Yep.
Yeah. So, you know, they seem to have a pretty good success by simplifying their technology setup and using, you know, more water. It's unfortunately from the ocean, but they have a wonderful site that allowed them to, I think, you know, be successful. And now, of course, they're looking to other places around the world to site their next farm. But they have a very tight search window. It has to have, you know, these really particular inputs that allow them to do what they do and be successful. So I think we'll still see some of those, but I don't expect those kind of projects to grow exponentially just because, you know, the setup is extremely specific. So I'm not sure that answers your question. I do think we'll see some of these other species also start to grow, particularly I think shrimp is poised to have a nice entry into both Europe and Asia. Of course, there are already projects for land-based shrimp in Asia. They're not huge, but they're, you know, testing out technologies in Europe. Of course, I think it's Ocean Loop. Bert Wecker's project is, you know, after a couple of years of piloting and coming up. And homegrown shrimp in the U.S., I think, will actually be a seed for further development of land-based shrimp in the U.S. So I do see shrimp actually gaining some momentum. And in the next 5 to 10 years, I would expect there's to be considerable production from land-based RAS for shrimp.
Brian, thanks so much for joining us and lending your insights. And we'll certainly be checking in with you as time goes on.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Well, that wraps up this week's edition of the IntraFish podcast. Thanks for joining us. Remember that you can find us 24/7 on IntraFish.com. You can download our app there, and you can also go to Apple Podcasts or to Google Play and subscribe to the podcast so that when we publish a new episode, it goes right to your phone. Also, just a reminder, if you will be at Seafood Expo North America in Boston on March 11th, we will be hosting our seafood leadership event there. We have a fantastic lineup of speakers, including Trident, Cargill, Whole Foods, Hy-Vee, Highliner, Slade Gordon, on and on and on. Go to intrafishevents.com. We hope to see you there. Talk to you next week.